Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's opening day special. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today as we're covering both of Chicago's baseball teams in lieu of opening day coming up later in the week. We've also got a very special guest on, someone who is quite famous yet controversial, especially in the baseball world. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the local area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Mucci World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Down Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park, or give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. So before we get to our special guest today, what we're going to do in this show is break down both the Chicago Cubs and the Chicago White Sox, talk about each position on each team, and then in the end, have a prediction on how many wins and losses each team will compile. So today, we're going to start off talking about the Chicago Cubs. Last season, they won 92 games, finishing in first in the NL Central, yet they ended up losing in the NLCS to the Dodgers, a 4-1 series loss. So looking at the position, starting at catcher. This year, the starter will be Wilson Contreras, and without a doubt, last year, actually, he really burst onto the scene, hitting 21 homers, 74 RBIs, in only 428 plate appearances. 117 games is the equivalent. If Contreras could have put a full season under his belt, playing in maybe 135 or 140 games, I could see those numbers going up even more. Contreras caught fire and was a very big spark plug for the Cubs offense. I see him providing that same role this year at the catching position. To back him up, there was an interesting story coming out of camp. Right now, it has been confirmed that Victor Caratini, who spent some time last season at both the major and minor league level, will be backing up Contreras. And Chris Jimenez, who was signed by the Cubs to technically be Yu Darvish's personal catcher, will start the season in the minor leagues. Now, Caratini was a former top prospect, and last season in his first taste of Major League Baseball did okay, to say the least. He hit .254 with an OPS of .689, so not the best, but at AAA last year, his numbers were much better. Caratini hit .342 last season in 83 games at the AAA level with 10 homers and 61 RBIs. So the key for Caratini is, if he's able to adjust to Major League pitching and hit it the way he was hitting back in AAA, he could be a viable option off the Cubs bench for pinch hitting opportunities and also back up Wilson Contreras, getting some time in at catcher when Contreras is unable to play. Shifting to first base for the Cubs, this one is not really that much of a question. Anthony Rizzo will be starting there this year, and last season had a very good year despite the lower batting average. Although he did hit .273, he still bashed 32 homers, 109 RBIs, and had an on-base percentage just under .400. I mean, those numbers are quite similar to Joey Votto's. Although Rizzo is already a perennial all-star, if he can move his batting average up a little bit and get it up to that .300 level, we could be talking about Rizzo as a more elite player, somebody who could be contending for the MVP award every year. So, very possible to see Rizzo break out in that sense, especially when entering his age 28 season this year. Moving over to second base, multiple options for the Cubs this year. Right now, the front runners to play the most at that position include Ben Zobrist and Javier Baez, but if you're talking about opening day starters, I feel that Baez will be getting that start. Last year for Baez, a big season, one in which he broke out mostly because he finally got some regular time in the field. He had 23 homers, 75 RBIs, a .273 batting average, in a total of 508 plate appearances. So for Baez, a big year. And as we know on defense, he's probably one of the best second basemen in the game today. You look at Zobrist last year, mostly a year to forget for him. hitting .232 with an OPS under 700 with 12 home runs and 496 plate appearances. Now, obviously, you can argue that Zobrist, number one, was hurt for most of the season, had a number of injuries that nagged him throughout the year, but also, he is still a very clutch player, and there's still value to him even as he enters this age 37 season. So while Baez will most likely be starting, and without a doubt in my mind, that's the way it should be, especially considering how Baez is much better with the bat as well as in the field, but don't forget about Zobrist, because we could be seeing him getting some innings at second base and also getting some innings in the corner outfield spots at left and right. Moving on to shortstop. Tough year for the Cubs last season because Addison Russell, the usual starter, was hampered by number one, personal issues, and number two, injury problems. Last year for Russell, most likely a year to forget, although he did hit 12 home runs and 110 games, he also hit .239 for an OPS of .722. Russell this year is going to be the consensus shortstop, but we could see some other guys getting innings there, including Ian Happ. Happ last year, another dynamic rookie, and we'll get to him later when we also talk about the outfield, because Happ is a multi-positional player, very similar to Ben Zobrist. But as far as this year goes for Addison Russell, hopefully with all these distractions off the field completely done, hopefully with the fact that he has recovered from all of his injuries that hampered him last year, he can finally break out the way he's supposed to. I'm still waiting on Russell to break out, because in AAA, and even while he was coming up as a prospect, he was lauded as a great hitter, somebody who could be hitting .300 at the major league level. Well, I'll tell you one thing, 2015, 16, and 17, that hasn't been the case, and Russell needs to step it up. Hopefully this year, with all of his issues resolved, he'll be able to contribute more for this Cubs team. Moving on to third base, very similar to the first base position, Chris Bryant is a lock to play. Last year, 29 homers and 73 RBIs while hitting .295. Many said that Bryant, for some reason, did better last year than his MVP year. You can try and argue that point with me, but you're surely mistaken. His MVP year was much better, considering his power output and his RBI totals. Last year was really a down year for Bryant, and even though he did have a better batting average and a higher on-base percentage, as far as his contributions to the team via home runs and RBIs, they both took a hit. This year, Bryant looks to bounce back and return to his 2016 MVP form. Now we get to the outfield, and that is just an entire mess for the Cubs right now because there are so many guys who can play in those positions. Then we've got other guys who are competing for spots. I mean, it's really quite an interesting situation, yet one that the team really needs to figure out if they want to advance far into the postseason this year. So right now, the consensus left fielder is going to be Kyle Schwarber. Now, Schwarber last year, we all know the story, hit .211, did hit 30 home runs, but really struggled out of the gate and was sent down to AAA. Now, apparently, quote-unquote, he has lost a lot of weight. He's looking very good in spring training. I want to see how he does in the game before I am sold on him. Another player to see some time in left includes Ben Zobrist. We touched on him earlier, how he had a down year offensively. Zobrist could be playing in left if Schwarber does not do well out of the gate. And if he starts the way he did last year, Zobrist could really eat up a lot of innings out there. You've also got Ian Happ, another player who had an awesome rookie season. 24 homers in 115 games. Granted, he did hit .253, but still an .842 OPS, which is something that I can take. Hitting .253 with 24 homers in 115 games is ideal for Ian Happ. And actually, if you want to compare, those numbers should be similar to Kyle Schwarber's. If Schwarber can hit .250 this year, if Schwarber could put up those types of numbers in that amount of time, then yes, he will be deemed a success in my eyes. Ian Happ is a younger version of Kyle Schwarber, but one who is more successful, in my opinion. In center field, the situation is more clear than it was in years past. Now, obviously, Dexter Fowler is gone, we all know that, and last year, there was a platoon situation occurring between Albert Almora Jr. and John Jay, but this year, Jay is gone. He signed a deal with the Rays, making Almora, by default, the starting center fielder. Now, Almora last season, actually, kind of broke out offensively, and that's always been a concern of his because even in the minors and even being scouted as a prospect, Everybody was very high on his defense, but always said that he needed to work on the bat. Well, it turned out to be right last year, as Elmora really broke out, hitting .298 with 8 home runs and 89 hits across 323 plate appearances. If Elmora can keep that offensive output up while still providing his Gold Glove caliber defense, he could become a rising star in this Cubs lineup, and in fact, for the entire MLB. So he's someone to watch for this season. And then finally, going to right field, it's going to be Jason Hayward. Whoop-de-doo in my opinion, but nevertheless, we'll look at Hayward. Last season did better, actually. Hit .259 with 11 home runs in 481 plate appearances. So that's actually an improvement from the year before. The problem is, though, is that it's not actual Jason Hayward-esque numbers. The year the Cubs got him, he came off a career season in St. Louis, hitting .291 with 12 home runs, making the All-Star team. With the Cubs, although he has won multiple Gold Glove awards, his offensive output needs to get better if he wants to see increased playing time, because 481 plate appearances in 126 games does not complete the entire season. If Hayward wants to see upwards of 600 plate appearances, he needs to be able to hit at least .270 consistently. Then he could be helping the Cubs lineup as well as helping them in the field. On the mound, the Cubs most likely have one of the best starting rotations in baseball. And that's something that the team has to pride itself on if they want to win a lot of games this year. So right now, here's how the rotation shakes out. You've got John Lester. Last year, a bad year, actually. Although he did go 13-8, his ERA was 4.33, his highest ERA as a member of the Cubs. Hopefully, Lester this year can turn it around, and I feel that he will in this environment. Then you've got Kyle Hendricks. Last year, hampered by injuries, but when healthy, still very effective. 7-5 record, 3.03 ERA, and 139 2/3 innings. We all remember in 2016, Hendricks was nearly winning that Cy Young Award. Led the league in ERA at 2.13, won 16 games. We need that Kyle Hendricks to come back strong and able to play in 2018. We've also got Jose Quintana, who the Cubs acquired last year in a midseason acquisition, and he did awesome for the team after coming. Went 7-3 with a 3.74 ERA, quite respectable, plus 98 strikeouts and 84 and a third innings pitched. So Quintana last year had a great season, or half season, with the Cubs. Hopefully he can continue that success coming into this year. And then we've got a new addition, Yu Darvish coming to the team. Last season, a 10-12 record, an ERA of 3.86, but he still averaged more than 9 strikeouts per 9 innings. Darvish is a strikeout machine, and he'll help anchor this rotation near the top. And then finally, the team also has Tyler Chatwood, who they acquired via free agency from the Colorado Rockies. Now, last season, kind of a year to forget for Chatwood, went 8-15 with an ERA of 4.69. The year before, however, 12-9, 3.87 ERA, and that's pitching in Coors Park, a notably hitter-friendly stadium. If Chatwood can provide some depth for this rotation in the number 5 spot and eat up at least 160 or 170 innings, he'll be a valuable piece of this rotation. And finally, we go to the bullpen and the closer's role. The Cubs did lose Wade Davis, and that's a problem because Davis last year did very well for the team, converting 32 of his 33 save opportunities. The good thing is, though, that the Cubs ended up acquiring Brandon Morrow via free agency, and he had an amazing year with LA last season. Now, although he did not close, he was a setup guy, he still had a very good year. Hopefully, he can make the transition to the closer's role and support the Cubs in the bullpen. Therefore, taking all of this into account, my prediction for the Cubs is as follows. 94 wins and 68 losses. They'll definitely win the NL Central Division. But coming into the postseason, I do have some doubts about the team as far as their bullpen goes. Last year, we saw its problems with Carl Edwards Jr. And obviously, this year now, without Wade Davis, will Morrow be able to step up to the plate and deliver when needed? I feel that the Cubs will make it to the World Series, but will end up losing. I do not think they have enough firepower to win like they did in 2016, but it'll still be a memorable year for sure, just not a year that involves a World Series victory. Well, with that, now we're going to shift gears, go to the south side, and talk about the White Sox. Again, position by position we'll be talking, and then in the end, we'll talk about a prediction. Let's start at the catcher position. Now, last year for the Sox, their primary catcher was Omar Narvaez, and last year he did okay, hitting .277 with two home runs. This year, though, the Sox decided to spend some money, signing former Cub Wellington Castillo away from the Baltimore Orioles. And last year, Castillo did have a year to remember. He hit 20 home runs to accompany 53 RBIs, all of this occurring in just 96 games, so a really good year for Castillo. He's known to be an okay defensive catcher, but his offense has turned down over these past couple of seasons. Hopefully, if he can continue this output, he can really help the Sox, who have been a catcher-needy team for some time now. They used to have Alex Avila, but when he came to the Sox, his offense did not work out. And Deonner Navarro, another guy who is known to be a good offensive catcher, yet could not hit well on the Sox. So Castillo needs to break this curse of problematic offense for a catcher and help out the Sox this year with his bat. Moving on now, we're going to go to the first baseman, and that is Jose Abreu. Last season, a resurgent campaign for him, hitting 33 homers with 102 RBIs, hitting .304. Abreu last season had a year to remember. Some of his stats were actually very comparable to his rookie year in the league. Hopefully he can continue that production, keep that OPS above 900, and help out his team with his bat. Next, we go to second base, and last year, Yoelmer Sanchez really made a mark on this team. We had talked before on a previous podcast about how he got a raise via arbitration, and it was much deserved, because last season, he had .267, an OPS of .732, 12 homers and 59 RBIs. That's a very good year for Sanchez. So he already got a raise, and now he's got the starting spot locked down, and he's actually a pretty productive second baseman. He could field quite well, and those numbers at the plate are definitely above average and respectable. Look for Sanchez to contribute more offensively, possibly inflating his power numbers as well as his batting average. At shortstop, that's another stalwart in Tim Anderson. Anderson last year, an okay season, hitting .257 with 17 homers. His problem is always going to be his on-base percentage. Last year's on-base for Anderson, a mere .276, which is quite awful. He did have an OPS of .679. If Anderson can move his on-base percentage to at least .320 while hitting .270, he could be one of the more premier shortstops in the league. But until he can move that on-base percentage up, he's going to have trouble establishing himself as a household name in the league and even on this team. Luckily for Anderson, he does have some pop, hitting 17 home runs. Hopefully that total can move up to the 20 to 25 range and help this team on offense. Moving to third base, multiple players played the position for the Sox last year. They had Todd Frazier, but then they dealt him at the trade deadline, and they've been using Matt Davidson. And right now, according to the Sox official depth chart, it looks like Davidson will be the starter come opening day. Now, last year, he actually had a breakout season with his bat, hitting 26 homers, but batting .220. Davidson was actually a former top prospect, but never really broke out in the way that he should have. Last year was a big season for him. It allowed him to establish himself as a good enough major league hitter while providing enough power numbers to help out the Sox offense. If Davidson can move his batting average up to the area of .240 to .250 while maintaining his power output, he can really be a force for this White Sox team and could establish himself on more than a regional level. He could become one of the better third basemen in the game. So look for Davidson to really make a move this year and help out the White Sox with their offense. We're going to move now to the outfield. Multiple players, a lot of different situations. We'll start with the obvious. Melky Cabrera was on the team last year but got traded. He is now gone. In his place to play left field is most likely going to be Lurie Garcia and Nicky Delmonico. Now, Garcia last year had 9 home runs and hit .270 in 326 plate appearances. And Delmonico hit .262 with 9 home runs and 166 plate appearances. Both guys, quality players who could be seeing some time in the outfield. In center field, it looks like Adam Engel will be starting come opening day, and although he did hit 166, which is something that really needs to be improved upon, or else he may lose his spot, he did provide some very good defense, even robbing a home run in the middle of last season. Engel is a very good defensive-minded player. He needs to provide some sort of bat, though, or else he could be finding himself on the bench quite quickly. And then in right field, locked down is Avisail Garcia, a great year for him last season, hitting .330 and .885 OPS, 18 homers, 80 RBIs. He broke out entirely. And I have to say, up until last year, I called Avi a bust, plain and simple. I did not think he would be able to produce at the level that he did. I was not confident in his skill set, but he proved me and a lot of people wrong, including many Southside fans. Garcia hitting .330 was a huge storyline for the team last year, and hopefully he can continue that offensive output. Then we've got other players as well. Yoan Moncada, a rookie last year with .231, will be seeing some time at second base, could even be starting over Yomar Sanchez, depending on how everything plays out. We've also got Luis Robert. Unfortunately for him, though, he has gotten hurt. He won't be back until the middle of May, but once he comes back, look for him to make a difference in the lineup. And then Tyler Saladino, utility player. He's played third, short, second, and first. Saladino last year, a .178 batting average. Not a year to remember offensively. Hopefully, he could come back this year refreshed and recharged and ready to help out in whatever role that he gets. Moving to the starting rotation, many moving pieces from last year. Here's the Sox starting rotation last year, and it goes as follows. Derek Holland, Miguel Gonzalez, Mike Pelfrey, James Shields, Jose Quintana, and Dylan Covey. Out of those guys, the only two players still on the team right now are Miguel Gonzalez and James Shields. They'll both be a part of this year's rotation. Shields last year, a year to forget, 5-7, 5.23 ERA, and he's now entering his age 36 season. So, judging at his age, judging about last season, it's only going to get worse. I hate to say it, but that's the truth. Shields is not going to get any better. He's not the James Shields of old in which he could pitch 12 complete games in a season and pitch to an ERA under 3.0. I'm sorry, it's just not going to happen. Hopefully Shields can continue to eat innings for this young ball club, and eventually he'll be out of here once the younger pitchers develop and the Sox have a more solidified rotation. Until then, though, Shields will be starting opening day for the White Sox. They've also got Miguel Gonzalez, who actually did not do that bad for the team last year. In 22 starts, went 7-10 with a 4.31 ERA. He was actually traded at the trade deadline, but the Sox re-signed him this offseason. Gonzalez, mostly a journeyman pitcher, but in his major league experience, has not done too bad. I mean, his career ERA is 3.95, and he's had a couple of good years with Baltimore before coming here to the White Sox. So Gonzalez will provide some innings and will provide some depth for this rotation. Someone else to look for this season is Lucas Giolito. Last year with the Sox, 3-3, 2.38 ERA in 7 starts. The Sox originally acquired Giolito via a trade that involved Adam Eaton, and he really did well last year. Hopefully he can provide that same force in a full 30 to 32 start season. Another part of the rotation for the Sox this year will be Reynaldo Lopez, whom the team also acquired in that same trade with Giolito. Last season, Lopez did okay, pitching to a 3-3 record with an ERA of 4.72. He's a very hard thrower, and that's very good for Lopez. What his problem is, though, is that he needs more control from his secondary pitches, and he needs to be able to be more of a pitcher and not necessarily a thrower. Actually, Lopez's narrative is quite similar to C.C. Sabathia when he was early on in his career. Sabathia was known mostly as a thrower. He was a very hard thrower at that and was quite successful for a bit, but once things took a bad turn, he had to realize how to pitch, how to locate fastballs, how to locate off-speed pitches and throw from behind in the count. Lopez needs to master that technique before he can really be a true ace of this staff. Hopefully Lopez will continue to learn this year and get some good opportunities and good experience under his belt. Next up is Carson Fulmer, and he did quite horrible in his first year with the team, pitching to an 8.49 ERA. Last year, much improved, 3.86 ERA, 3-1 record and 5 starts in 7 games total. Now, Fulmer was not necessarily supposed to be a part of the rotation, but with Carlos Rodon hurt to start the season, Fulmer will occupy the 5th spot. Fulmer right now needs to simply work on getting more experience at this point and being successful. Right now, he's a mixed bag. His first year was horrible, last year was a bit better. Fulmer needs more experience and more innings under his belt for me to truly judge how good of a player he'll be at the major league level. And then finally, we've got the aforementioned Carlos Rodon, who is currently hurt, but once he becomes available, he'll really help this team. Rodon last year, a 2-5 record, but a 4.15 ERA in 12 games started, 76 strikeouts and 69 and a third innings pitched. Rodon is a good player. We've seen it already. We see his potential. His rookie year was good. His sophomore season was actually pretty good as well, pitching in more games and getting more innings. Once he comes back from this injury, he'll be a very good spark plug for this rotation. And once Shields and once Gonzalez leave, because they're just stopgap players, I can see Rodon really becoming the anchor and the driving force behind this starting rotation. Of course, however, he needs to recover fully from his injury before he is back on the field and ready to go. And finally, going to the bullpen, multiple names right now in contention to become the closer. The top two are Joaquin Soria and Nate Jones. Now, we talked about this a bit in our last podcast that we had about this closer situation. And right now, it's kind of a toss-up. It could be either or. Soria, more experience, obviously. A former All-Star at his position being a closer with the Kansas City Royals. But Jones has been with the Sox for a long time. His entire career, actually. And has done quite well. I think because of Jones' experience and knowledge with Coach Don Cooper and with the franchise itself, I feel that he will be the closer come opening day. Now, could that change? Of course. If Jones does not perform at the level that he is capable of, Soria will always be there to run in and swoop that position away. But right now, come opening day, I feel that Nate Jones will be the White Sox closer. As far as the prediction goes, I feel that the Sox will improve from last season, in which they went 67-95. If I had to guess, I'd say the Sox would win 75 games this year and lose 87. A big improvement for this team. They are trending in the right direction. They are following the model that the Cubs did involving rebuilding. And by 2020 or even 2019, this team could be in the playoffs. We just have to wait for their prospects to mature and be ready to star at the major league level. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his MLB career in 1984 with the Boston Red Sox. By 1986, he had won his first of 7 Cy Young Awards, as well as the American League MVP Award. Following his tenure with Boston, he won 2 Cy Young Awards and 41 games over 2 seasons with the Toronto Blue Jays. In 1999, he became a member of the New York Yankees, helping the team win 2 World Series titles. He was also a member of the Houston Astros, winning yet another Cy Young Award there. Throughout his career, he won 354 games, made 11 All-Star teams, and posted over 4,600 strikeouts. Please welcome the Rocket, Roger Clemens, to the show. Roger, how are you doing today? Thank you for being here on the show. It is quite an honor to have you here today.
I appreciate it. Doing great. Just staying good busy with a little work with the Astros and chasing my 2 younger boys around and becoming my nickname has changed a little bit from Rocket to Poppy Rocket. My oldest boy had twin boys not too long ago. So.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So we're getting them going.
So first off, I'd like to take a look back at your illustrious baseball career. I mean, the numbers you put up were simply amazing, ones that really may never be matched. What was your secret? How were you able to maintain the success for such a long period of time?
Well, I was fortunate. I was, for 24 years, I was fairly healthy at times, you know, a few stints on the disabled list, but for the most part, you pitch 24 years, you pitch a couple decades and you make adjustments and changes along with, you can look at what we just talked about that's fresh on my mind, talking to some young college pitchers that were just here doing a little work about the difference in the mound. And early in my career, you know, there was not really a requirement on the height of the mound. I mean, I think I was on some mounds that were 15, 17 inches high, And those were the days when you could drop and drive. And I think your listeners, you know, like a Tom Seaver, I was fortunate enough to play with Tom Seaver about for a month. He came through Boston, and I got to watch him up close and personal and how he dropped and drive the ball to the plate. And there were some, a handful of other pitchers that really did that. The second part of my career, they made a little bit adjustment in the mounds. I think they're supposed to be about 11 inches. So the drop and drive days are over because it flattens out your ball. And so you just want to feel tall and work downhill to try and create angles. So that was a big part of it. My work ethic that I got from my mother and my grandmother, you know, stayed with me all the way through. And, you know, it was just, you know, like I said, I was pretty lucky to, you know, in the early part of my career, face people like, you know, Reggie Jackson and George Brett and Robin Yount and Paul Molitor. And then next thing you know, I'm facing the Pujolses and, you know, the Griffies and guys like that. So, you know, just always a good challenge, and just fortunate that I had some great teammates, some fantastic catchers that paid attention to detail when I was working out there, and then of course I tried to retire a couple times. It didn't work, so I had came back out, and I was you know, really happy that I decided to play three wonderful years in my hometown here in Houston.
You know, you mentioned teammates. I was quite curious. Who would you say was your best teammate, and who would you say was the biggest clown of a teammate?
Well, I just had some great teammates. I mean, I think most people know, you know, see me on the mound on game day when I'm very serious about my work. I'm pretty laid back, and I cut up and try and be funny with the guys and make sure they're having a good time when I'm not the days in between when I'm not starting. But you know, I just had some great teammates. It was fun to watch. Like I said, when I was 21, 22, 23, something like that, you know, I had the likes of, you know, Jim Rice and Dwight Evans and Bruce Hurst. You know, Hurstie gave me my nickname, the Rocket, after I struck out 20 for the first time. And but I just had some fantastic teammates there, and then they went on to, you know, where I had a great young staff and really team when I was in Toronto with the likes of Sean Green and Carlos Delgado and that. But I had some veteran catchers in Darren Fletcher and Charlie O'Brien. I think Charlie O'Brien, he got a book out called Cy Young Catcher. I think he caught like about 11 Cy Young Award years.
Wow.
And, yeah, so I had some great, you know, I had Tony Pena in Boston, Rich Gedman, and the list goes on and on. I mean, the thank yous that I owe to the guys that caught me over my career. You don't have a career like I do and think you do it all by yourself. You have so much help from teammates, and definitely the catchers. Had some fantastic managers. Some of the managers really didn't have to manage us personally. You know, they could fill out the lineup card because we had a lot of all-stars at a lot of positions. But what the really good managers did, they handled our personalities. You know, the 25 guys in the locker room, they would handle our personalities fantastically. And also really handle the media in some sorts. And when you're talking about a big market like Boston and New York. So that was good also.
You know, speaking of your career, you touched on it a moment ago, the 20 strikeout game back in 1986. That total broke a record that many thought was unbreakable. Then 10 years later, you did it again. I mean, it's quite remarkable. Can you give us a recollection of those games? And, you know, what was going through your mind during that time? Were you able to notice that the record was in reach? Were you able to realize what you had accomplished?
Yeah, neither game did I realize that I was approaching 20 strikeouts. The first one against in 86 against the Mariners, I had no idea about not only a Red Sox strikeout record, but I wasn't aware of a Major League strikeout record until my teammates told me in the ninth inning. I think I had, after the eighth inning, I had 18 strikeouts. And I went upstairs to change undershirts under my jersey, put a dry T-shirt on, and the other pitchers were kind of looking at me and pacing in a little bit, and I could tell they're, you know, wanting to say something to me, but not sure there. I, you know, similar to when a guy's throwing a no-hitter or something, I guess. So I asked them what's going on, and they said, look, we got to tell you because we don't think you really realize what's going on here, but you've got 18 strikeouts and 20 is the major league record. So I was fortunate to go out there and get that, and then 10 years later in Detroit, I wasn't aware of it either. I was just trying to get through the game and really just keep doing it, and then after the game, I was made aware that I had 20 racked up 20 strikeouts again. But I think the thing for me, being a power pitcher and having a great pitching coach early in my career like Bill Fisher, and Bill Fish still holds the, I think, the major league record for not allowing a walk in like 89 innings without a walk. And he made point of that, not only in my first one because he was the pitching coach, but he was on down the road 10 years later when I did it the second time, and he gave me a phone call and let me know that he was most proud of me. He said it was great that, you know, you struck out so many guys and all that, but he goes, what's even more impressive, you didn't walk a guy, you didn't walk a single batter in either one of those games. So that's all the way it's always been for me since, you know, when I was in high school. My high school coach would bring me in games. We had a couple kids that threw really hard, but they couldn't throw strikes, and, you know, I was a strike thrower, and I could throw my little curveball that I had back then over for strikes, and I was fortunate to really have good mechanics early in my days, and nobody really messed with me too much, and I would watch different guys, you know, obviously a Nolan Ryan and like I stated earlier, having a Tom Seaver, you know, watch where they got their leg drive and some of their power from, so that helped me too.
So another memorable moment for you must have been winning two World Series championships with the Yankees back in 99 and 2000. Before then, you had many personal accomplishments, of course, but how did it feel finally winning a World Series with your team? Despite all of those accomplishments personally, what did this mean to you, winning something with the team, being able to become a world champion?
Right. So, you know, you get, I think I was in six World Series over my 24 years, and it was, you know, it was just, you know, 1986, we came so close, one strike away from beating the Mets. Very emotional series. I tell people two of the losses were very emotional World Series losses. The first one was big time emotional because, you know, we went back and forth before we even got to the World Series during the championship series against the Anaheim Angels. We went back and forth with them, and I think they had us down to one strike, and Dave Henderson hit a big home run for us and got us back in it, and we ended up winning that and getting to the World Series. And then the crazy series against the Mets, and so, but you know, that was a taste of the World Series. You know, I was coming off a college World Series victory, so I was just expecting that that's going to be the way it's going to happen. You know, we're going to battle all the time and have an opportunity to get in a postseason play and get to the World Series. But anytime you have a chance to win a World Series, the two victories were fantastic, but you're so close so many times. As a starting pitcher, if you can go out there and, you know, approach 20 wins, which seems to be the watermark for a starting pitcher, but you have to have another starter, you know, win 17, 18 games with losing only about 10 or so to come along with you. Or like you said, you'll win these individual awards and you go home and watch the playoffs on TV. It's not a lot of fun. So anytime that you know, you were mowing them down and you had another pitcher, maybe two, come along with you to get it done, was always special. And, you know, it holds true. It's going to hold true for the end of time, that pitching and defense is going to get you to the dance. And once you get to the playoffs, you got to win 11 ball games. So you can kind of dumb it down or simplify it and just worry about winning 11 games once you get there.
So while we're talking about the World Series, there is a question that I have to ask. In the 2000 World Series, you were on the mound, and Mike Piazza hit a broken bat ground ball that went foul. Now, the barrel of the bat, however, came back to you, and you threw it back at Piazza as he was running. Can you tell us what happened there?
Well, you just made a mistake in words because you said I threw it back at him while he was running. I had no idea he was running, and I got a broken bat back at me, which, right out of the gate, I thought it was the baseball. I think his bat broke in like four pieces or something like that. But it was strange because as I was expecting the ball to come at me, the bat came back at me. I filled it with great form, actually, and I grabbed it and just threw it to the on-deck circle, and he was running. I think the TV and their views of it made it look like it was close to him, but it was not really that close to him. And then after that, we got on with the playing the World Series. So I guess it was great for ratings and everything, but like I said, people make the comment all the time about that you threw it at him. If I wanted to throw it at him, I'd have thrown it at him, but I had no idea he was running, and I don't think he did either.
So we're going to fast forward now, going to 2004. A report came out compiled by Senator Mitchell regarding performance-enhancing drug use in Major League Baseball. Now, your name was involved in the report, and you had to testify in front of Congress. Because of what happened, there are some people who suspect that you used PEDs or other steroids. Now, I'd just like to get your side of the story on the issue. What are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, I've already told my side of the story on that, and we've already proved my case, so that's a done deal. So we basically stopped the guy from out there trying to make a little money off of us and running around telling people a number of different things. But we got in a fair setting, and we deal with just facts, and the facts came out, and what we knew would come out came out, and it worked out the way we wanted it. It was trying and taxing on a lot of people, but like I said, when you have somebody out there telling lies about certain people and you have family that it hurts and a number of other people, you handle it the proper way, and that's exactly what we did.
Now, you mentioned the money there. Do you feel that your name was included because of money and because of publicity, or because the report found something noteworthy? Mostly the money is what I'm hearing from you. Is that correct?
We stopped the guy from making money off our name, basically, is what we did. It had nothing to do with anything else. That's all it was, and it was pretty much a dog and pony show of everybody that everybody watched it in the comments that I got from everybody.
So because of this report and other accusations, your candidacy with the Baseball Hall of Fame right now, it's been stagnant. You have gone up a bit, though. You're at 57% of the vote going in now to your seventh year on the ballot. In your mind, do you believe you are a Hall of Fame player?
I don't worry about the Hall of Fame. I have zero control over that. I've made those comments many times, so I appreciate the guys that look at the facts and have made their votes and making votes. That's really cool. But I never played the game to worry about trying to make it to the Hall of Fame or anything like that. I played the game because I love to play it, and I knew early in my career I could help my family, my mother that was, basically did so much for me as a young person with my father passing away when I was young, and she worked three jobs, so she's really, special to me. She's since passed, but she was special to me and worked so hard and providing for us as a family. That's what you think about as a player early in your career, that, hey, I have a chance to, do something here and be able to set my family up. And then after that, it's pretty much about winning and winning championships and focusing on doing your job.
So I wanted to go back to your achievements and your numbers. You compiled 354 wins in your career, which is unbelievable considering the starting pitching area in today's game, how pitchers are really unable to even go five or six innings, very hard to even win 20 games these days. You were also one of the last pitchers to accomplish this feat. So in your opinion, do you think we will ever see another 300 game winner?
I'm not sure that it's really hard to tell, but like you said, there's so many specializations now where guys, your starters, they're protecting them. Obviously it has to do a lot to do with what they're paying the guys, and they look out for us. I think I can speak on my behalf. Early in my career, they really kept an eye on my pitch count. The middle part of my career, not so much. And then the latter 6 years or so, they kept on my pitch count, too, just for the fact of my age. I was 40 years old or whatever, and they wanted you fresh in September and October, and so they kept an eye on it there, too. But, guys, there's so many great arms in the bullpens these days. If you can just get through the lineup almost two times, they can, they can start bringing guys in the seventh that throw extremely hard. Your eighth inning guys the same way, and a lot of the closers are throwing almost triple digits now. So, just depends on how you set your bullpen up. Similar to our hometown team here, which I feel that they've gotten, winning the World Series, they went out and got better. Our general manager, Mr. Lunau, he went out and got Garrett Cole and the other guys. You got some swing guys in McCullers and everybody that stepped up last year, so you're hoping that's the case. So, yeah, I think, you got to watch your for health reasons. I especially in the National League, when I was with the Astros, we were in the National League, and I remember Jimmy Williams and I working on my bunting when I came over from the American League, and he made a comment that if you can handle the bat and show me that you can get a bunt down or two, I can leave you in the seventh, maybe eighth inning. It'll add up to about five wins on your record over a course of 31, 32 starts, and that's exactly what happened.
You mentioned about specialization with pitchers today. What do you think about that? Because I know, in your career, you threw 200 innings even at age 41, and today's pitchers are lucky if they can get to 175. Do you have any thoughts on the idea of specialization and how it contributes to pitchers not necessarily lasting long in games, not even getting to 200 innings in a season? Is that a problem for you?
Well, it's not. I mean, again, like I said, you got to know your pitchers, you got to know your veteran pitchers, and you got to know your young pitchers, and you got to be able to communicate very well with them and understand, you know, what's going on. I think the best thing that happened for me with somebody like a really great pitching coach I had with the Yankees, Mel Stottlemyre. Mel and I had a great relationship, and he could tell when I was running out of gas a little bit, and then we'd have a little relationship in the dugout where, you know, they were wanting to bring somebody in, and I would basically convince him to let me go back out and start the inning and go one hitter at a time, knowing that if that guy got a base hit or I walked him, I didn't get him out, that I knew I was coming out of the game. So it gave me even more incentive to really bear down on the first hitter and try and get him out, and in turn get us deeper in games, get a few more outs so we didn't have to tax our bullpen. So those are the things that you have to watch. You have to watch, you know, like I said, there were games in Houston. I was 42, 43 years old, and April and May I was in a lot of very close ball games, 3-2, 3-1, 1-0 games through seven innings, and it was real taxing on my body, and really it really beat you up mentally. So it's totally different, though, when you turn the corner and you have basically the same 120-pitch game, but you win 7-2 or something like that. It's just it's your body as a pitcher feels totally different the next day.
So I wanted to shift gears, talk about what you're doing today. You're with the Houston Astros, of course. You're still around the game of baseball with your sons, one of which has been drafted by the Toronto Blue Jays, the other playing baseball at the University of Texas. How gratifying is it for you to see your sons succeed in the game, just like you did?
Yeah, they love the game. It's a baseball family. So Kobe, my oldest, played 10 years professionally, was a fantastic hitter, and we were hoping that he would have an opportunity to continue on, but he's doing wonderful things now. He's teaching 7-year-olds to professional guys, and really enjoying it and making a difference in a lot of the young kids' lives. My second oldest, Corey, selling energy here in Houston. Casey, as you alluded to earlier, is with the Toronto Blue Jays, and Cody's holding it down as a middle infielder with the University of Texas. So they love the game of baseball. I think it teaches the kids a lot of things. I'm just as proud that, you know, Casey graduated from the McCombs Business School and Cody's in the Communication School at Texas. So that's just as important. I love it that the two younger boys got to play for Augie Garrido and now David Pierce, which are fantastic coaches, but even better teachers of the game. And so that was pretty cool for them to do that. Like I told both the young boys, that I had the opportunity to play for Cliff Gustafson, who was the winningest coach of all time, and then the boys got to play for Augie, who just recently, as everybody knows, just passed. And it was a little bit of a shocker to us because he was just with us 2 weeks ago when we were at LSU, sitting with us at the LSU game and looked great. So it was a little bit of a shock to hear that what had happened. But, yeah, the boys love the game of baseball. Like I said, it teaches some life lessons, and I really enjoy that they, you know, want to have the opportunity to chase their dreams and have fun with it. I like the work I'm doing. Even though I do some work with the Astros, I've got probably about 20 major league pitchers that I visit with. Really, it's just the mental part of the game. Every once in a while, we get detailed and talk mechanics. But the beauty of it is we got TiVo, so I can tape a lot of these games and go back and watch them in about 15 minutes, or watch a really crucial one or two innings that they're pitching and be able to help them with their questions.
So your post-baseball career also includes some acting. You've appeared in shows like The Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, and Spin City, while appearing in the movies Cobb, Anger Management, and Boyhood. Why did you decide to get into acting, and is this a hidden passion of the Rockets?
Well, we've had some fun doing it. You left out Kingpin. We had a little fun doing Kingpin with the Farrelly brothers. They're always funny and a little bit crazy. So, but the Ty Cobb movie was fun. Tommy Lee Jones was he's a fantastic athlete. He played football at Harvard, and I thought he did a really good portrayal of Ty Cobb. I think the movie was running at one point when there was maybe a strike looming or something like that. So it kind of hit the theaters and then came back, but done some fun stuff. Yeah, Arliss is fun. Robert Wall's a really close friend. He calls himself my Hollywood agent, and so we have fun with him, and he's actually went to the University of Houston here And but we have fun with all the guys. There are certain things that come up and we get asked to do, and we had to turn down a bunch because a lot of times I was active and obviously couldn't get away from the team to go shoot the segment or a movie part. But yeah, they're fun. If you see the script and they're fun, and you know, you just go out there and have fun with them. So I think the boys and my closer friends around town, everybody, they get a kick out of it.
So with your acting experience and baseball career already on the table, what is one thing about Roger Clemens that people don't know?
I don't think there's not too much they don't know about me, other than some of the people that that, you know, get to be in a golf outing with me or around me a little bit more and see the lighter, funner side of myself and how I like to have fun. Totally different when I was working, obviously, because, again, like I said, I think I got those traits from my mother. She took her work very seriously because she was raising a family of six, and that's the way I was brought up, to be dedicated to my work and focused on it, and that's exactly what I was. And then I want to make sure that everybody's having a good time, you know, when I'm not out there locked in. I want to make sure everybody's having a good time and having fun, and we do that. I love the game of golf. Like I said, we get out there, and I met some really cool people through the game of golf, and have some fantastic friends that are on the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour now, actually. So it's fun playing with those guys and hearing their mindset and how they approach a golf course and do things like that. So yeah, we're having fun with it.
So being such a great pitcher, do you have any advice for young pitchers playing the game today? How can they be successful and make it to the next level? Anything maybe specific or anything that you have come across in your career that you could pass down to some younger pitchers today?
Well, we have a ton of information, and I do a lot of work with Dr. James Andrews, who specializes in those areas, and I think Doc and I are in the same boat as far as, I love it when kids play other sports. They don't play, you know, specialize in one sport all year round, and they do need to set the glove and the ball down and rest a little bit. You know, they're playing a lot, and so we try and encourage the kids to play another sport or at least take a break, you know, for a little bit in the game that they're playing. The issues that you're having with a lot of the guys' shoulders and elbows, it's, you know, it has to do with, you know, mainly you can watch some guys and see it in their mechanics, really, where they can do a few things where they can take some stress off their shoulder and elbow. And it's just real important, like I said, nowadays, since the mounds are so low, they've lowered the mounds. You can put a lot of, you know, stress on your arm and elbow, your shoulder and elbow, if you're not doing some things properly. So I'm getting so many letters at my foundation to maybe do a video or put something out there online that I'm, once my, you know, I keep thinking it's going to slow down for me, but like my grandmother said, there's no grass going to grow underneath my feet. So we're on the move, but we work with a lot of the kids, and I try and give some advice back when I get the letters or notice my foundation, and hopefully one day maybe myself and Doc will, you know, we worked hard on the pitcher's 10 throwing program and the shoulder program, the elbow program. So hopefully maybe one day we'll get something out there so these moms and dads can see it.
That's awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
On a final note, this being an opening day special podcast, I'd love to hear maybe your best opening day moment or what opening day means to you now that it's coming up too this week.
Yeah, it's just exciting. I think the teams that know they're good really feel you know, pretty good about their chances. You always worth, you know, you're wishing guys great health. I think when you talk about these teams that are really, really good, and they look great on paper, you obviously, you got to keep guys healthy to, you know, for the 6 months to have a great run. But opening day is exciting for a lot of people. It'll be really exciting here in Houston for the fact that they're going to have the championship banner. And I think the ring ceremony will be the very next day after their home opener. So looking forward to that. They just did a fantastic job bringing a championship here to Houston. And so I'm just looking forward to seeing the guys and being a part of it.
Well, Roger, thank you so much for being here on the show today. It was such an honor. Really glad to have you on.
You bet. Thank you.
Well, there you have it, folks. Roger Clemens on today's show. Such an honor to have him on. I mean, this guy was one of the most premier pitchers during his era. I mean, 354 wins, 4,600 strikeouts. The numbers are simply ridiculous. It was an honor to have him on. A special thank you to him for agreeing to come on the show. And a special thank you to Diana Holland over at the Roger Clemens Foundation for setting this all up. Well, thank you all for listening to today's podcast. Make sure to check us out on Twitter at Chi Talk Sports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. Also, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can type in your email on the subscription box on the main page of the site, and from then, you will get email updates whenever any new content is posted, either an article or a podcast. Make sure to do that to stay up to date on anything that we post on the site. Thank you again for listening, and happy opening day to all MLB fans out there coming up later in the week.